Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, March 2, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will hear a Freddie and Fannie shareholder litigation update. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us John Carney, editor at Breitbart News, and Jason A. Levine, litigation partner at Vincent & Elkins. I will turn it over to Jason to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Jason. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Laura, and thanks everyone for dialing in. My name is Jason Levy. I'm a partner at Vincent & Elkins here in Washington, D.C., and I will provide background about the Fannie-Freddie litigation with a focus on the recent D.C. Circuit decision in the Perry Capital appeal, which was long awaited. And then after about 15 minutes, I'll turn it over to John, and I believe John will focus more on the underlying economics, financial implications, and the practical effects of the net worth sweep, in addition probably to picking apart some of the comments that I make about the litigation. So by way of disclosure, let me note that I do not currently represent any parties or any amici who are involved in the case or any of the cases, but I have advised some clients on the proceedings and on the possible outcomes. And frankly, that's the reason why I've followed the matter closely enough to talk about it today. So let me just start with some background. You know, as an overview, the Treasury Department's net worth sweep, as the plaintiffs call it, and is a convenient shorthand for it, from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, can be viewed in very, very different ways, depending on who you are. For the investors, for example, one might say it's essentially a theft by the government of tens of billions of dollars that they otherwise would have made on their investments in Fannie and Freddie shares. People for the government might say, really, this was just a price that was reasonably paid to the government for a bailout of companies that were going to fail. The judicial distinction might be along the lines of the actions that were taken here in the net worth sweep were really the proper actions of a conservator whose job it was to try to rehabilitate Fannie and Freddie and possibly put them into operational condition. The other side of that would be that it was ultimately an unauthorized act of a liquidator or a receiver pretending to be a conservator and acting outside their authority under the statute that gave them power to act in the first place. So that distinction is ultimately the one that drives the decision in the Perry Capital litigation. By way of background, you may know this already, but in case anyone doesn't, obviously, the financial crisis of 2008 had a major impact on Freddie and Fannie, which were two very important players in the housing mortgage market in America. They were both created by the government to buy mortgages from banks, to package them as mortgage-backed securities, and then to sell those securities to investors, institutional investors, private investors. They pretty much make the market, I think it's fair to say, in mortgage-backed securities. In the 1980s, both of them became publicly traded and stockholder-owned companies. So in reaction to the financial crisis, in 2008, Congress passed the Housing and Economic Recovery Act, HERA, which created a new entity called the Federal Housing Finance Agency, the FHFA, to oversee Fannie and Freddie. FHFA was directed basically to ensure that the companies operate in a safe and sound manner and was vested with the power to anoint itself as the conservator or the receiver of Fannie and Freddie, including the authority to, among other things, preserve and conserve their assets and property, to take actions needed to put them into a sound and solvent condition, or conversely, to wind up their affairs as a receiver. HERA also authorized the Treasury Department to buy securities in Fannie and Freddie, and it limited judicial review of the FHFA's activities, basically barring claims for equitable relief that would have interfered with FHFA acting as a conservator or a receiver. So in September of 2008, FHFA's director placed Fannie and Freddie into conservatorship. That was the term used. The Treasury then entered into stock purchase agreements with both companies. and the shares that the Treasury bought entitled it to a liquidation preference, which increased whenever Fannie and Freddie drew funds from the Treasury. Plus, it was also entitled to quarterly dividends equal to 10% of the liquidation preference. So in other words, 10% repayment scheme every quarter, plus warrants that gave Treasury the ability to buy up to 79.9% of their common stock. And the funding cap was initially set at $100 billion per company, huge, huge amount of money. In 2009, it rose to $200 billion. They didn't draw quite that much, though. As of June of 2012, they had drawn approximately $187 billion combined. That was through the first quarter. In the second quarter, I believe they did not actually draw money. And it was at that point that Fannie and Freddie looked like they might be turning the corner and becoming profitable again, which is a big issue of factual contention in the litigation. And they have more or less remained profitable since, with some volatility. And this is really where the controversy starts, because in August of 2012, the FHFA and the Treasury Department adopted an amendment to the stock purchase agreement, and this is the so-called net worth sweep. And it replaced the 10% dividend repayment scheme with the new requirement that Fannie and Freddie must pay a quarterly dividend to the Treasury equal to their entire net worth, minus a capital reserve that would be ultimately eliminated in 2018. And none of that money was actually credited toward paying back the debt. It did not work off the liquidation preference. So basically, Fannie and Freddie's profits were being remitted directly to the Treasury, but they were not, after the net worth sweep, actually making any progress on paying back the debt that they owed the Treasury Department. So that arrangement has worked out fairly well for Treasury. You might say it's worked out well for taxpayers, given the money that's come in, but it's been at the expense of investors in Fannie and Freddie stock, certainly at least in their eyes. The investments made by a lot of those investors dropped in value when the government took the net worth sweep on, particularly the preferred shares that entitled holders to dividends when they were declared and also to their own liquidation preference in the event that Fannie and Freddie were liquidated, which affected the stock price for the companies because it affected their future discounted cash flows and their value. So in 2013, there was a series of lawsuits filed in the district court in D.C., in the Court of Federal Claims here in D.C., there was an interesting one filed in the District of Iowa, and these suits made various claims, but they ultimately center around claims that the government acted outside its authority, FHFA, acted outside its authority under HERA, and also violated the Administrative Procedure Act, and those claims sought injunctive relief against the net worth sweep. There was also a class action in the district court in D.C., which claimed that the net worth sweep breached the terms of the stock certificates for Fannie and Freddie's stock, basically breach of contract claims. There were also accompanying fiduciary duty claims under state law, and there were takings and illegal exaction claims. So I will not try to talk about all of that. It would take way more than an hour or my small amount of allotted time to try to do that, but I'll focus on the most important parts of it. The district court in D.C. dismissed the complaints before it, the Perry Capital complex of complaints under Rule 12b-6, failure to state a claim. In a nutshell, it held that HERA's limitation on judicial review or equitable relief barred the claims for violation of HERA or the APA. It held that the fiduciary claims were barred because the FHFA succeeded to the rights held by the private stockholders, so it could not in essence sue itself. And it also held that the contract claims were not ripe because Fannie and Freddie had not been liquidated yet, and the court concluded that that would be the trigger for any possible breach of contract claim. Obviously, that was appealed, and the D.C. Circuit just recently issued a 2-1 decision. Judges Millett and Ginsburg were in the majority, and Judge Brown dissented. The D.C. Circuit affirmed the dismissal of the statutory and the APA claims. It affirmed the dismissal of the fiduciary duty claims, but it remanded certain of the contract claims, and those are the ones for money damages, finding that, in fact, they were right. Judge Brown would have reversed the entirety of the decision. Now, the panel decision was 76 pages long. The dissent is 27 pages long, so I'll try to confine my comments to the high points. I'm happy to answer questions. Most importantly, the court ruled that HERA prevents judicial review of the claims for injunctive relief because there's a section of HERA providing that no court can take any action that would restrain or affect the FHFA's exercise of its powers as a conservator or a receiver, and therefore injunctive relief is just barred on the face of the statute. Now, the plaintiffs claim that that bar really does not apply because the FHFA exceeded its authority by contending that it was a conservator but really acting like a receiver that was winding up Fannie and Freddie, and it was essentially playing a hybrid role, doing both at once, which the statute didn't authorize. The court rejected that argument, concluding that all the powers granted to the FHFA by the statute were discretionary. They were may do powers rather than shall do powers. And so there was no actual command in the statute for the FHFA to do anything particular as a conservator. The court also concluded that the actions that were taken, even in the net worth sweep, could be viewed as actions a conservator would take. Now, to me, parenthetically, it seems as though there was some poor legislative drafting here. The distinction between a conservator and a receiver was not crystal clear. The roles overlapped quite a bit. There are different definitional sections which, you know, may give rise to a cert issue should there be an effort to get to the Supreme Court. The majority also found that the claims for breach of fiduciary duty were, in fact, barred by this succession clause, as the district court had found. And on the breach of contract claims, the ones that sought money damages, the court found that these survived dismissal. They were direct claims on behalf of the shareholders themselves and should not be dismissed. And they sought damages roughly involving amounts of money that were equivalent to the dividends they would have received, but for the net worth sweep, the value of their lost liquidation preference, ultimately, you know, billions of dollars. The court found that they were ripe. They didn't require a liquidation. They were essentially claims for anticipatory breach of contract, and they should be decided on the merits by the trial court. So the question on remand will be whether the net worth sweep violated the reasonable expectations of the parties when the plaintiffs purchased their Fannie and Freddie shares. And in particular, the district court will need to be mindful of when the plaintiffs bought their shares. For example, was it before or after HERA was enacted? Was it before or after the net worth sweep was put into place? Now, Judge Brown's dissent takes very strong issue with the panel's reading of the statute, noting that it bars equitable relief only when FHFA acts within its authority. And the court, Judge Brown then focused on HERA's appointment of FHFA to act as a conservator or a receiver, but not both at the same time. FHFA said it placed Fannie and Freddie into conservatorship, and HERA lists certain acts that the FHFA may take as a conservator or a receiver. It separately lists powers of FHFA as a conservator. It separately defines powers as a receiver. And what the FHFA did here, in Judge Brown's view, ultimately in the net worth sweep, fell more along the lines of a receivership based on the powers enumerated in the statute, yet the FHFA professed to be acting as a conservator, a very difficult conflict that was not resolved well by the agency in her view. She also then explored the common law behind what conservators and receivers do, which the majority really did not explore, and concluded that the actions that were taken by FHFA were really a sub rosa receivership when it was professing to act as a conservator, and that there should have been judicial review in her view and the possibility of injunctive relief to prevent the FHFA from completing its roles in this way. The majority really did not credit that distinction in the same fashion. So the case now will be remanded to the district court. The trial court will need to assess the contract claims for money damages. There are separate claims still pending in the Court of Federal Claims, and it may very well be that a cert petition will be forthcoming from the plaintiffs in some fashion, disappointed in their overarching claims against the government. as opposed to just the contract ones. Now, very, very briefly, and then I'll turn it over to John, you know, I have some opinions about the way the decision might have been better formulated, which I'm happy to talk about if people have questions about it. In brief, I think the proper course for the D.C. Circuit might instead have been to reverse and remand the question whether the FHFA exceeded its power as a conservator, given basically the confusion in the statute as between the conservator and the receiver roles. You know, to the extent you're talking about investor expectations, certainly investors who bought stock based on a conservatorship would have had their expectations upended by the switch to receivership. If you bought Fannie and Freddie stock thinking that the FHFA was going to rehabilitate the company, you certainly would have been surprised in 2012 to learn that it was about to arrogate to itself all the profits of the company. So in that respect, there may well be grounds for certiorari. Predicting the merits in the court would be a very difficult proposition. As for the contract claims, it seems as though even the majority of the D.C. Circuit that remanded them really didn't disagree that at least some purchasers of Fannie and Freddie stock will be due money damages for breach of contract. And as a matter of expectations, that seems to me to be the right result. I think it should also extend to purchasers before the net worth sweep, because, again, it's hard to see how there would have been an expectation that such a measure was going to be put in place in 2012 after having heard multiple public pronouncements about how FHFA was going to rehabilitate and resuscitate Fannie and Freddie. So I would think that a decision at least in favor of contract claims and money damages for the buyers before 2008 would have a very good chance of prevailing. And if nothing else, it seems to me that the litigation showcases a need for meaningful judicial review of government action, which here HERA really tried to foreclose. And it was particularly unfortunate here given the fact that this is a very important matter involving huge sums of money and very influential and important institutions caught up in an emergency situation. In some sense, the kind of scenario in which judicial review might play an important role. But if it also highlights the fact that sometimes in emergencies, Congress will enact legislation that's well-intended, but perhaps a little too hastily and without giving sufficient definitional clarity to the terms it uses, which I think was a flaw here in terms of the conservatorship and receivership. That's 15 minutes, so I think I should yield the floor to John, and hopefully we'll have questions.
Hi, thanks, Jason. My name is John Carney. I am the economics and finance editor at Breitbart. I should say that everything I say here is my opinion and analysis and shouldn't be attributed to my co-writers and editors. So I wanted to just give a little bit of background on the net worth sweep and how it functions and why it was put in place originally and what the effects on the shares have been. So as Jason pointed out, when the companies were originally given money by the Treasury, so there's actually two parts to their bailout. The FHFA became the conservator of Fannie and Freddie, and the Treasury signed a pair of stock purchase agreements, one with each company, that laid out the terms with which the Treasury would supply capital to these companies. And that involved both purchasing what's now known as the senior preferred stock that originally carried an annual dividend payable quarterly equal to 10% of the amount the company had drawn down on Treasury's commitment to them. In addition to that, they were supposed to pay a commitment fee on the undrawn amount. How large that commitment fee was never settled. The agreement said a reasonable commitment fee to be agreed at a later time. No commitment fee was ever agreed. In total, the companies drew the initial amount was $1 billion, and then every draw on top of that added to the amount of the dividend that was going to have to be drawn. For several quarters, actually so a few years following their initial bailouts, Fannie and Freddie did not make enough money to pay the 10% dividend. They had several quarters in which they lost money. And so the first thing that happened was the commitment fee, the U.S. Treasury waived the commitment fee, saying, you know, it doesn't make sense to further weaken the companies. And what the companies were forced to do in order to be able to pay the commitment fee and not default on their obligations to the U.S. Treasury was to draw down even further on their bailout in order to pay the money right back to the U.S. government. So this was known as became known as a circular draw. You were taking from the Treasury in order to repay the Treasury, and the effect of this was to actually ramp up the amount of money that the companies owed each quarter to the U.S. Treasury, because the amount of the bailout was actually increasing, and therefore 10% of it increased as well. There was a lot of attention focused on this in early 2012. People realized that if this were to go out, so the U.S. Treasury's ability to increase the amount of capital they could provide to these companies, their statutory authority ran out in 2009. The end of 2009. So in other words, it was now capped at $200 billion per company, $400 billion total. $187 billion had been drawn, and there was fear that if they needed to keep drawing in order to repay the 10%, that you would at some point you would cross a threshold in which the market would become concerned again about their viability. And as Jason pointed out, these two companies are central to the U.S. housing market, which is central to our financial system. And people legitimately feared that we could spark another financial crisis just because of the mechanics of this. So we got to $187 billion. Nobody knows exactly when foreign investors, U.S. investors, purchasers of mortgage-backed securities would begin to become concerned that the companies were getting too close to the edge of being unable to pay their obligations to U.S. Treasury, and therefore would be unable to pay their guarantee obligations on the mortgages they had guaranteed. So there was a lot of talk in early 2012 that perhaps this mechanism would be changed. Some people argued that if we merely lowered the amount of the dividend to say 5%, that would provide some relief to the companies, perhaps end the circular draws. The companies themselves, in both statements to the media and in their public filings, said that they did not believe that they would ever be able to pay the 10%, that it was just too much, and that, you know, Freddie Mac's CFO at the time told the Wall Street Journal, we do not foresee a future in which we can pay the 10%. The government there was a lot of resistance within the Obama administration to lowering the dividend to 5% for fear that this would seem as if they were going easy on the companies and would create a sort of Republican backlash against what had happened, a sort of second bailout. You know, they couldn't afford their first bailout, so now you are lowering the amount of what they owe the U.S. taxpayer, in effect, bailing them out a second time. They came up with instead the mechanism of the net worth sweep, which went from a fixed dividend to a floating dividend, so that in the future, in quarters where the company couldn't pay a dividend because it had a loss, or only could pay, you know, a much smaller amount than 10%, that was fine. They could pay that. But in quarters where the companies do better, then they have to pay even more. So in other words, the risk actually and the reward became balanced between, when they do well, the U.S. Treasury will do well. When they do poorly, the U.S. Treasury will not be paid. Shortly after the net worth sweep was instituted, the following year in 2013, the companies had record profitability. And this raised a lot of eyebrows. People said, speculated that the government may have known that they were going to have record profitability. That's been a contention in some of the one of the things that the plaintiffs in the claims court are believed to be pursuing evidence of that. When the net worth sweep was collecting tens of billions of dollars more than the government would have collected under the 10% regime, those claims seemed a lot more plausible. One of the things that happened last year is both companies actually paid less than they would have under the 10% regime, which lends credibility to the argument that the net worth sweep really does balance risks and rewards and is not merely a sort of grab for all of the profits of the company. I think so that's sort of the mechanism and the history of the net worth sweep. I think it's very important to look at what happened to the stock price of the various securities in the summer of 2012 when the net worth sweep was instituted. I'll start with the common shares. They don't move. The shares had actually run up a lot in the days preceding the announcement of the net worth sweep. I mean, by a lot, I mean several cents. They were trading at a range of 24 to 28 cents, I believe. And when the net worth sweep comes in, they had gone up to 28. They go back down to 26, where they had been about a week earlier, and trade around that range for the following few months. This hurts the argument that investors had an expectation that the companies would become profitable enough that the investors would be able to see some of those profits someday in the dividend, because once those dividends get cut off altogether, because the companies literally have no positive net worth going forward, because it's all paid to the U.S. Treasury, the stock doesn't change. There's also, even though there was a temporary downturn in the shares of the preferred stock, it doesn't stick. It goes down a little bit, but if you look very quickly, it recovers and actually now trades at several times what it was trading at before the net worth sweep came in. I think all this is relevant because it makes it harder for the plaintiffs in the case to show that they had any damages at all. They could sell right now and they would receive a price far better than they had before the net worth sweep was instituted. To get to one point that Jason raised, and then I'll end my soliloquy. The notion that being placed into conservatorship created an expectation that they would be rehabilitated, I think is misguided. The conservatorship, first of all, the history of U.S. conservatorships by the FDIC is very thin. It's a tool that's almost never used by the FDIC. And typically when it is used, it is a bridge conservatorship that ultimately leads to a receivership and a liquidation. In the very statute of HERA, it contemplates exactly that, that receivership terminates conservatorship, so that the government is allowed to put the companies into conservatorship and then is allowed to move it into receivership if it desires to do so. So the law itself makes it very clear that conservatorship does not create an obligation to return them to the status quo ante or to some new vibrancy where they will exist outside. It, in fact, speaks of a conservator or receiver being able to do several things, including wind up the companies. And so, perhaps that shouldn't be the case. As Jason said, this might not be the ideal way of drafting the statute and the differences between conservators and receivership. But there is, historically, we don't have a lot of experience with conservatorship. There's not really a great definition of what a conservatorship means. In the United States, we typically do not have the government take over companies only to later release them as healthy companies. A government seizing a bank typically means that bank gets shut down, sold off, and the equity investors almost never receive anything at all in those situations. I'm happy to answer questions, but that's I think enough for now.
Great. Let's go to audience questions. Well, first, Jason, would you like to respond to anything John said?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that John and I are not particularly butting heads over much here, but I would make a couple of points just to add to what he said. The first is that, it may, with regarding the stock prices, I think, though, that the crux of the investor's claim has to do with the huge delta between the amounts that to date has been paid back to the Treasury Department versus the amount that was actually taken from Treasury. It was $187 billion taken. It's something like $264 billion that have been paid back. So on the order of $80 billion straight to the Treasury without the debt being reduced, certainly there's a chunk of that that the investors would say would and should flow to them based on their preferred holdings. And then in terms of the conservatorship receivership point, I would mention first, in addition to what John said, that adding to the difficulty here is the fact that the FHFA in 2008, said in public statements that it was taking on the conservatorship for the purpose of rehabilitating Freddie and Fannie, for the purpose of propping them up, putting them into a sound and solvent condition to be operational for the long term. Now, you might say they've remained operational, the conservatorship served its purpose. But then there was this evident shift that John mentions and which Judge Brown focused on into receivership mode. And, it may be that the statute could be read to have contemplated a shift, but the problem is that receivership typically also triggers certain procedural protections, certain notice requirements that were not in place here. There was just this abrupt, one day we're acting as conservators, the next day we're taking the net worth sweep and are, in a sense, now automatically becoming receivers. The majority of the D.C. Circuit seems to think, even after the net worth sweep, they were still acting as conservators, not receivers. Perhaps the statute contemplated a shift, but it certainly seems awfully murky. And again, to the extent that receivership means that there are procedural protections, notice, due process, hearings, and so forth, that didn't occur here. And I think that may not be something that the plaintiffs played up very much in their briefs to this point, but it seems like something, worthy of consideration should the litigation go forward. I think that's all I have to say.
Let's go to audience questions. Oh, would you like to respond?
Oh, sure. I'll just say one thing that I think is a huge risk here that neither the that the plaintiffs in the cases haven't really contemplated, which is, I believe that if there's a substantial chance that if a court were to try to strike down the net worth sweep at some point, that the FHFA would then put them instantly into receivership. Under the statute, it's very clear that they can do this. So, in other words, a plaintiff victory in the cases could actually be a Pyrrhic victory, because the government has a backup plan when it comes to this. They can put the companies into receivership.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll go to our first question.
Hi, I was wondering, what's the role of the boards, with Fannie's board and Freddie's board, given that the FHFA is calling most of the shots on this?
Jason, do you want to try to answer that?
I can take a shot at that, John, and you may know a little more about it than I do. But my understanding of it is that Fannie and Freddie's boards are really not empowered to contradict the FHFA with respect to these sorts of decisions. They've still got roles in terms of operation of the companies and so forth, but these much larger macro decisions that FHFA has power to institute under HERA, the boards, certainly they could confer with FHFA, lobby FHFA, try to persuade them, but I believe that ultimately they cannot force FHFA to act other than the way FHFA wants to.
That is my understanding as well. The FHFA can appoint and remove board members. So in essence, they serve the FHFA. There was an interesting political dust up when the board and the FHFA approved increases to the compensation of the executives of Fannie and Freddie, and Congress passed law that said I believe they passed it or threatened to pass it, that said do not raise their compensation, and so it didn't happen.
Yeah, in fact, even recently, there's a decision in a case called Pitzel, U.S. versus Pitzel, or Pitzel versus U.S., where Mr. Pitzel, who was the CFO of Freddie,
right?
Yeah, had basically a golden parachute in his contract, and at some point his employment was terminated, and rather than getting the proceeds of his termination clause, the FHFA ordered that he not be paid that money because it would have been detrimental to the financial condition of the company, and the board had to do what FHFA said, and that's now in litigation that may end up seeking cert before the Supreme Court. So far, Pizzle has lost.
We have another caller, so I'll go to the next question. Go ahead, caller.
My question is whether or not any of the plaintiffs in any of the litigations have asserted that the government has violated the Statement and Account Clause and or Appropriations Clause in accounting for the Fannie and Freddie over the years, and that the stock purchase agreement was originally enacted to perpetuate that fraud.
I'm not aware that they have.
I do not believe that anybody has done so.
No.
All right. Our floor is – oh, would you like to continue?
I was going to say that there probably has been commentary to that effect. There's a lot of commentary about these cases, but having seen the complaints, I don't recall ever seeing a cause of action along those lines.
Our floor is open, so again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. In the meantime, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Friday, March 3rd. That call will feature a discussion of Barry Friedman's new book, Unwarranted Policing Without Permission, with the author, Professor Barry Friedman, Professor of Law at New York University School of Law, Professor Orrin Kerr, Fred C. Stevenson, Research Professor of Law at the GW University Law School, and our moderator will be John Malcolm, Director and Senior Legal Fellow at the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions, I have a question for you, Jason. Do you think the case has any implication for Congress curbing the courts in this way?
Well, I think it probably does. You know, this is much of this litigation turns on the limitation on judicial review that's contained in HERA, which prevents any action that would restrain or affect FHFA in the performance of its duties. Essentially preventing a court from ever entering an injunction that might stop FHFA and basically preventing judicial review of a claim for an injunction so that, you know, you're never going to get to the merits of such a claim. This decision in the D.C. Circuit is very long, talking about this matter at a conceptual level, but it never actually gets to the merits. I think that this case could potentially spur some consideration of the appropriateness of judicial review bars, such as you see here, both because of, you know, the fact that, in a sense, it was ineffectual because there's been tremendous litigation anyway, but also in the sense that, you know, perhaps to the extent that those bars are used, they might be crafted more narrowly and more sparingly, given that, number one, even here you see there was still a lot of judicial activity despite the ostensible bar on cases like this. And also because, you know, when you've got very, very important public policy matters involving hundreds of billions of dollars in particular, it perhaps is wise in a nation like ours to allow the courts to be involved and potentially step in if the government is overstepping. So I think there may be consideration of this issue once the dust from the litigation starts to settle.
I have a thought on that, because I believe that one of the reasons that when the law was drafted, people wanted to bar judicial review in these types of matters. One, it already existed in other laws, and so it was sort of imported into this one, but. The part of the idea behind why you wanted it in for the government's conservatorship or receivership of Fannie and Freddie was that you wanted the investors in mortgage-backed securities, as well as the people who purchased the actual funding debt issued by Fannie and Freddie, to be able to rely on the statements of the FHFA and the U.S. Treasury without worrying about the judicial branch nullifying the statements of Treasury and FHFA. In other words, the part of the goal here was to restore market confidence in the companies and not have a sort of the shadow of doubt of judicial review. And then second, again, one of the things not having judicial review here may mean is that to the extent the Treasury or the FHFA overstep what perhaps they should be doing, the answer to – and there is no judicial review, the answer is legislative. And that may be part of the goal of cutting out judicial review. In other words, we want, these companies are so important that we want matters for them to be decided by the elected branches of the U.S. government rather than the appointed, and you know, particularly through normal lawmaking procedures. And so it may be a choice to have it be controlled by the executive and the legislative rather than the judicial.
Again, our lines are wide open, so please press the star key and the pound key on your telephone keypad. Another reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform conference calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleform conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleform calls you may have missed. I'll make a final call for questions. Please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad to ask a question. But not seeing any, would either of you like to make some closing remarks?
Well, this is Jason. I guess I would say first, thanks again to everyone who dialed in, who listened to us. And this is a case that litigation that likely will go on for some time. I don't think this is the last you'll hear of it. I would expect that the Perry Capital matter will make its way toward the Supreme Court. Whether it ultimately gets there will have to be seen, but I think it will certainly, there will be an effort to get there. And the litigation that's pending in the Court of Federal Claims, which also presents a different take on some of these arguments and is exclusively for money damages, is on a separate track, and there really are not precedential decisions there yet on any of the merits issues. So that will be interesting watching as well.
I think I have 3 points I wanted to make in closing. One has been just to touch on something Jason had said earlier. The companies have paid billions of dollars in excess of what they received, although that was actually, that is the planned and optimal outcome. The DC Circuit decision focuses on this. Under the original stock purchase agreements, the company repayments did not pay down the liquidation preference. The companies were not allowed to pay down the liquidation preference ever unless the U.S. Treasury agreed. The companies were not allowed to seek an end to their conservatorship, neither seek nor accept an end to their conservatorship without the U.S. Treasury. And they were not allowed to pay any dividends to anybody except the U.S. Treasury without the U.S. Treasury's explicit consent. I think all of this sort of undermines the notion that there was an expectation that there would that you would get more back. If you look, and as to the amount the companies paid back, the billions more, that is true, but it is also true of the successful TARP investments that the U.S. government made in banks. Those typically had a much higher return if you calculate it on an internal return basis, partly because the banks tended to pay back their the amounts they received much quicker. So in other words, yes, they pay back more, but this was structured as an investment that was supposed to produce a positive return for the U.S. taxpayer. And so they were always expected to. And then finally, I'll just point out that so far, we actually have several courts have looked at this. It's not just the D.C. Circuit Court and its predecessor, but there have been several other federal courts that have looked at this matter and come to similar conclusions and dismissed the cases. So There, and it doesn't matter whether the judges have been considered liberal or conservative, or Democratic appointee, Republican appointee. There's been a unanimity in the decisions that we've had so far, that to dismiss the cases, that at least in my mind creates a lot of doubt about whether or not the plaintiffs will actually prevail if this matter goes to the Supreme Court. You know, on this case itself, we had Judge Ginsburg and Judge Brown, two conservative judges, split. If the case similarly splits among conservatives on the Supreme Court, I believe that the liberals will rule in favor of the U.S. government's actions and the plaintiffs will lose this case. And so I agree that it's going to last a long time, but I am a skeptic that about it ever having a positive outcome for the plaintiffs.
The interesting thing about it with respect to the plaintiffs, I agree with John on the last point that the outcome of the Supreme Court is entirely uncertain, and if there's a split of the conservatives, I would agree that it would go the way of the government. But as he and I have discussed separately, the institutional investor plaintiffs are prepared, evidently, to take the risk because they're looking at the potential return and they're also diversified. So this is one of many things they're invested in. Some of them have actually doubled down on the litigation since and have bought even more shares because they are feeling like they can afford to try to be bullish on the possibility of a Supreme Court outcome that's favorable to them. Looking at it as a matter of arbitrage, if they see a return of X and a possibility of winning of Y, so long as the delta between X and Y is one that's within their investment guidelines, it's something that they're prepared to do. So I would think that they're going to continue this, and it will go on for a while.
And if I'm happy to come back and discuss the next chapter at any time.
So am I.
Thank you so much. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.